This is the sound of PCJ.
Media Network Plus.
Well, hello everyone. It's very nice to have you with us for another edition of the program. And that's the 55-minute version, or monthly version, of Media Network Plus. It's nice to have you with us. 2 weeks ago, on May 10th and the 11th, Radio Netherlands Worldwide did a 24-hour marathon to say farewell to its Dutch listeners because of a 70% budget cut that occurred last year. This was an event that went all out. We're going to be joined by Jonathan Gruber, host of The State We're In, and he's going to be talking about what happened and what will be happening next. At the same time, we're going to be joined by a fan and listener of Radio Netherlands Worldwide, Jan Osterveen, who set up something special for the broadcast. Then in the second part of the show, we're going to be putting the focus on Africa. Thomas Witherspoon of Ears to Our World, who has been with us a number of times before, will be talking about their 2012 plans. And then Janice Law will be joining us to tell us about the important role radio plays in South Sudan. We have this and much more, so stay tuned. This is Media Network Plus, bringing you something that will activate your brainwaves. But first, here's Paulette with a look at some of the headlines from the world of media.
Today, Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty mourn the tragic loss of Hasiba Shahid. Hasiba was involved in a car accident in Prague and died of her injuries. She was a fearless reporter who joined the RFE-RL's Kabul Bureau in 2003 as a senior reporter-producer for Radio Azadi. She moved to Prague 2 years ago to work as a broadcaster for Radio Mashal. During her time with Radio Azadi, Hasiba won 3 consecutive awards for best reporting in the service. She investigated the smuggling of women, which caused an uproar with a local warlord who pressured provincial authorities to silence Hasiba's reporting. Hasiba is 29 years old and is survived by her husband and 2 young children and an extended family in Afghanistan and abroad. French ADSL television platform Orange will close down its Orange Sport channels at the end of June. In their place, Al Jazeera's beIN Sport 1 and 2 channels will be offered to its subscribers after striking a deal with a Qatar-based broadcaster. Orange Sport has about 400,000 subscribers who will be offered the option to sign up to beIN Sport 1 and 2 from May 24th. beIN Sport 1 is expected to launch at the beginning of June. According to local press, Orange has signed up to distribute Al Jazeera's channels for 4 years. New figures show that BBC World News has burst through the 300 million distribution mark, increasing the number of households it broadcasts in by more than 40 million over the past year. Total distribution of the BBC's international news channel now stands at more than 330 million households, following recent deals with Comcast in the U.S., TV4 in Sweden, ERTSA in Greece, and DLife, a major distribution deal with Disney in Japan. BBC World News is expected to receive a further boost when it moves into state-of-the-art new broadcasting studios in London later this year, improving the look and feel of its international news output for audiences. BBC World News commercial director Colin Lawrence called it evidence of both a breakthrough year for the channel and our audience's increasing hunger for global news they can trust in very turbulent times. Full-time 24/7 distribution of the channel has also risen from 179 million to more than 200 million households, making it one of the biggest international news channels in the world. The DRM Receiver Task Group, represented by Ludo Mas and Mireia Martinez, has been to China to meet with various radio broadcasting organizations and companies. The meetings, with chipset manufacturers RDA Microelectronics and Silicon Labs, receiver manufacturers Philips and Texon, mobile phone manufacturer Nokia, automotive supplier Continental Corporation, and Chinese government broadcast agencies and organizations, including the State Administration of Radio, Film and Television, China Radio International, and others. Chinese government organizations are very interested in DRM, especially for international broadcasting on shortwave, and they are awaiting the official decision to be able to start regular digital radio broadcasts. If you'd like more information on these and other stories, we invite you to check out the blog for Kim Andrew Elliott. Just go to www.kimandrewelliott.com, and Elliott is spelled E-L-L-I-O-T-T. Or go to www.pcjmedia.com, and you'll find a link at the bottom of our homepage. I'm Paulette Macquarie.
This is PCJ Radio on 88.2 FM. This is PCJ Radio on 107.5 FM in Nairobi, Kenya. And nationwide on 5. This is PCJ Radio on KBCT in Waco, Texas. This is PCJ Radio on 9955 kilohertz to Latin America. This is PCJ Radio on 7590 kilohertz DRM. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio.
And you're listening to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio, and this is the 55-minute monthly edition of the program. We also have the weekly edition that you can find out more about at our website, which I will give out later on in the program. On May 10th and 11th, Radio Netherlands Worldwide said farewell to its Dutch-speaking audience after being on the air for more than 60 years. Last year, RNW suffered a massive cut. Its budget went from 46 million euros a year to 12 million. The new budget takes effect on January 1st, 2013, and for the final Dutch broadcast, they went all out, taking a listen to some of the most important highlights from all those years. Just before they signed off, we had a special studio link with RNW to find out what was going on. I was joined with Jonathan Gruber, host of The State We're In, and a listener of RNW, Jan Osterveen. Of course, we know about the drastic cut that took place at Radio Netherlands, going from 46 million euros to 14 million euros. And of course, cuts had to be made. A lot of staff is going to be leaving. Some staff is going to be taking early retirement and things like that. Were people surprised in the organization that Dutch would be the first language to go?
I don't think that people were entirely surprised. Well, first of all, just to be 100% careful about things, I think it really depended upon who you asked. I think that if those people had been observing what was happening in international broadcasting, those people who were familiar with what had been going on for quite some time, those people were, of course, not surprised, because large international broadcasters have been signing off one by one over the last decade. And so those people, including myself, were not at all taken by surprise when the cuts came. In fact, just speaking on behalf of myself, I was surprised that they hadn't happened earlier. I was expecting them actually in 2005, or at some point each year. I sort of was waiting for it to happen, and it just sort of never seemed to happen. So I think, having said that, I do think that a lot of people were in fact taken by surprise. And I base that upon not just how people in the building reacted, but also in Dutch media. The Dutch media was rather shocked by not just the fact that cuts were made, but by the fact that the cuts were so deep.
Mm-hmm. You know, the odd thing, though, that is kind of odd about this, I don't know if you're aware of this, but China Radio International is starting a Dutch service.
Really?
They're starting. They actually have an online site right now, which is for online content. Later this year, they're going to be producing a one-hour daily program in Dutch.
That is very interesting.
You know, and I wonder, like, you know, if people, the people in The Hague, actually where the funding for Radio Netherlands come from, if they knew this, what they would be thinking.
They probably will know at some point, especially because Radio Netherlands is being shifted from the Ministry of Culture to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And I can only guess that ministry is more clued into what is happening in that has anything to do with the Dutch culture or Dutch language that is created by other foreign ministries. So, you know, I'm sure that at some point they'll be aware of it and they'll probably listen and assess.
Now, Radio Netherlands is doing this marathon broadcast. The last time that this was done was in the 1970s for the 50th anniversary of Happy Station. What is the mood like? Because it's been going on now for a few hours anyway.
You know, I mean, if you just walked in here and you didn't know what this was all about, you'd think that it was some kind of mega party going on because there's a big old tent. There's things floating around in this nice sort of like pool that we have, a big pool out there. I'm actually, even as we speak, I'm watching through the window. I'm seeing giant stacks of speakers floating around on the pool, and I'm hoping they don't fall in because that would really be an expensive mistake. But there's live music and there's lots of drinks going around and there's hordes of people walking through the buildings and there's lots of smiles on people's faces. But then when I start speaking with people, like I have somebody who works on my show is Dutch, and she just worked on one of the she was directing one of the hours of the broadcast, and she came back and she just looked really, really sad. And, you know, we all asked her what's up, and she said, Oh, the mood down there is really melancholy. So, yeah, I think there is a tremendous sense of loss.
It sounds, the way you're describing it to me, like an Irish funeral. If you've got to go, this is the way to go. Just one big bang.
I suppose so. I mean, it is really big. I mean, a lot of other international broadcasters have closed down and just quietly went. And, to quote Eliot's The Hollow Men, this one is definitely – to misquote Eliot's The Hollow Men – this is going not with a whimper, but with a bang. Mm-hmm. So, I wholeheartedly approve, because something is being lost here. A lot of history. I mean, Radio Netherlands is considerably older and has a much more venerable history that can be traced all the way back to 1927, in a way that most other international broadcasters cannot do. So those of us who know the whole history of the organization do have a tremendous sense of something important passing.
I'm just curious, because the Dutch language service is going to be signing off for good in a few hours from now. What about the other languages like Spanish or Indonesian or even English?
Well, here's what I can tell you and what I can't tell you. what I can tell you is that in the course of this year, at some point, it is almost certain that those languages will sign off on shortwave. English, Spanish, Indonesian, etc. What I cannot tell you is when. They have, and that's probably because they just simply haven't decided exactly what the cutoff date is at that point. But it is almost certain that it's over. Now, there is some discussion, and I will not be held to this because it is nothing but discussion, about maybe continuing on in Spanish in certain parts of the world where future target areas. Free speech target areas that cannot be reached in other ways. That is only discussion at this point. Nothing is certain.
You know, I know that Radio Netherlands has changed their focus to provide information to parts of the world where free speech is limited or non-existent. But then in my head, I think, well, wait a second. If you're going to do that, in many of these places, people don't have access to the internet, or the internet is blocked. So how does that work?
Well, you know, that is the discussion that's taking place internally right now, which is in those countries, in those parts of the world that are going to be target areas, how do you reach those people? Which is exactly the reason why you're having a discussion right now about extending shortwave to certain parts of the world on a limited basis. But again, that is only just discussion right now. No decisions have been made.
So, as for the, if I can put it this way, the state of the state we're in, we won't know until much later.
Well, as for the state we're in, you know, earlier in this conversation, I stated that I was not surprised when the cuts came for Radio Netherlands. And the state we're in owes its existence to that kind of thinking that myself and another colleague, Michelle Ernsting, had back in 2005. We saw the writing on the wall, and we decided that if we were going to stay relevant and on the air, we had to develop a program that would not need shortwave. And as a result of that, helped to consolidate the efforts of the people in the English department, what was called the English department then, ended a lot of programs, moved all that money over towards the state we're in, and moved a lot of those producers towards the state we're in so that we could create a program that would be competitive in the American market, which is at that point in time what it was directed towards. We just needed our shows to get a whole hell of a lot better so that they would be able to compete domestically in the market and that we wouldn't need shortwave as a medium to reach people listening. In other words, we would get partner stations and they would just add it to their schedules and broadcast the show. And in that sense, the state we're in has been wildly successful beyond our dreams at this particular point in time. And we're in discussions with an American distributor at this point also to sort of take the program on and take over the distribution part, because Radio Netherlands simply won't be able to afford that.
And, you know, something that you just mentioned a moment ago that actually that's quite interesting. Like with PCJ, we actually have a number of partner stations as well. And I've noticed that when you have a show that airs, let's say, through a partner station on a medium wave or FM relay, it doesn't matter in what country, you get a very different audience than what you would, let's say, on shortwave to certain areas.
Well, if you're talking about the United States or Canada, we're also going on the CBC nationally, then you just basically get their audience. You get the American Public Radio audience if you're out in the U.S., and you get the audience for the CBC. And, you know, you don't get international listeners. I mean, you might get them, because they'll be listening to their local domestic broadcaster, but you just get whoever they appeal to, mm-hmm. whoever that demographic appeals to.
Here's something I think this might you'll get a kick out of this. In early March, I was in the United States attending a radio conference in a place called Plymouth Meeting in the USA, and they had a silent auction, and there was one guy auctioning off. Guess this, you're going to love this, tapes. Tapes of a show that you did, EuroQuest.
Really?
He had a batch of 20 of them.
Wow. What'd he get for
them?
Well,
actually, I was just curious, so I put a bid for like $1. And the final...
Oh, Keith.
The final bid for them, right, was $35. The money, of course, went to charity. So there's this one guy now, somewhere in the U.S., I don't even know who he is, but he now has this collection of 20 tapes from the Radio Netherlands, the old Radio Netherlands transcription service of EuroQuest.
That's crazy. I can't think of anybody wanting those.
Oh, you want to hear...
I mean, they're so long, they're irrelevant.
You want to hear something better? In Shanghai, I've come across in some CD shops... copies of EuroQuest on CD.
That's insane.
And they're selling them.
Why would anybody... That's insane. I could understand it if they were made of tape and you could just copy over them. But they were on CD.
Yeah, and some you could find them in China in some like CD shops, which is, again, I don't understand it because most of these shows are 10 years old or more.
Well, you know, they make it makes an excellent coaster.
Yes, exactly.
you just put your drink right on top of that. That's good.
Let's get to somebody who's actually sitting next to you, Jan Oosterveen. And Jan, before I get to the first question, I want to thank you, by the way, for some of the audio that you've sent me in the past. Now, at this farewell do for Radio Netherlands, you brought something mm-hmm. special. Now, some people would think that you're crazy. but you actually brought along a van, but it's not just a regular van, is it?
People telling me, Keith, that I'm crazy, it's not too far from the truth, I think.
So what about this van? What is the story behind this van?
Well, I was involved in getting the van here by a friend of mine, which I knew from the Radio Veronica offshore period. And he came across the old Radio Netherlands van, which was in the car museum in Schagen, is the place here in Holland. And he offered them to... take a whole overhaul for the equipment, and then that van could be transported here to the party tent here on the premises of Radio Netherlands. And we have used it last night, and we played, for example, a lot of old Radio Netherlands Happy Station tapes, etc. And we had a little exhibition here with other stuff like stickers and other gadgets like the 1988 piggy bank and that kind of things, flags and banners, all that kind of things. And from my own private collection, I brought a few technical parts from one of the transmitters in the Wörthertal transmitter site in Germany, where I have a friend, and I took a broken capacitor and a tube which was in the transmitter for a year.
Now, this is not just an ordinary van. This would be the. Is this the same van or the same kind of van that Radio Netherlands would have used, let's say, in the 50s and 60s if they were out reporting on a story?
That's correct. From 1958, they were built by a company in Amsterdam called Werkspoor, and they did convert the upper part of the van to a complete plastic thing and built it on a chassis from Chevrolet.
So this is really just a studio on wheels, you can say.
Yes, they used it to record concerts, church services everywhere, and even there is a small film on the internet that shows that when closing one of the dikes in Zuidelijk Flevoland, which is one of our polders they reclaimed from land from the sea, let's say, and. Yes, you can see there one of the reporters, I think it's Guus Weitzel, which is one of the old presenters here, and you can see him in that film with that same van.
And by the way, you can actually take a look at some pictures at the Radio Netherlands website, rnw.nl, and there are pictures of the van as well as the tent. And Jonathan, I'm really curious about that. That floating thing that you were mentioning it just sounds very unsafe.
Yeah, I'm looking at. Hold on, just hold on one second. I'm just looking up here. Yeah, it's like a big stack of speakers. They've got on some kind of boat, and it's like they pushed it out into the pond, and it's just floating back and forth.
Oh boy. Okay, so you know what?
It's a PA, right? Yeah. The technician just told me that it's part of the public address system.
Oh, okay. So the final broadcast will sign off in a few hours from now. Come Monday, does that mean all those people that are there today won't be there at all?
I was asking that question, and to be honest, I don't really know the answer to that. I don't really know what's going to happen to those people come Monday. Technically, nobody's been made redundant yet. That still has to happen within the building. So what exactly these people are going to do come Monday, I am not sure. I don't really have a good answer for you.
How is the whole thing ending today?
You mean like what's actually going to happen in the final hour? You know, I am not sure, but given the language that they are using around it, I'm expecting something explosive. because it says going out with a bang. And why else would you say that, right? I think they're keeping it under their hats. But if there aren't fireworks, I'm going to be pissed. That's all I'm saying. There better be some fireworks.
The way you're describing it, I'm wondering if the building is going to be blown up.
Shh, don't say that. I don't know. I don't think so. I think it's going to be pretty and sparkly.
Jonathan and Jan, thank you for taking some time out today to talk about this historic broadcast at Radio Netherlands. The final Dutch program is going out at this very moment. And by the way, this segment that we're doing right now is recorded. You're hearing it. Right now, the current time is just after 16 hours UTC, but you can still go to the Radio Netherlands website, rnw.nl, and check out what's going on. If you can't find a frequency for Southeast and East Asia or the Pacific, don't worry because you can listen to it streaming online. Jan and Jonathan, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
I was speaking there with Jonathan Gruber and Jan Oosterveen about the final Dutch broadcast from Radio Netherlands. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio, the 55-minute monthly edition. Why do I say monthly? Because we also have a 30-minute weekly edition, of which you can listen to through our website or through one of our partner stations. But the website I will give out a little later on in the show, as long as some other information. Thomas Witherspoon of Ears to Our World, a U.S.-based charity that sends self-powered shortwave radios to teachers in third-world countries, has been on the program before. While I was in the United States in March, I had a chance to connect up with him to find out their plans for 2012.
Well, first of all, we continue to do what we're doing with shortwave radio and sending self-powered shortwave radios to teachers in third world countries and in remote areas of the world. Also, we've tried to put a focus on some availability of pre-recorded content. So we're looking at devices that make sense in the areas where we're sending them, appropriate technologies that will allow people to have pre-recorded content. It can be educational, humanitarian, informational. It can be entertainment. But we want people to have the ability to play things over and over and over again or record broadcasts that they hear over shortwave radio.
Now, since the last time we spoke, of course, the economy is a lot different now than what it was. Are you finding it more challenging now to get donations and to get sponsors for Yisrael World?
Yes, it is. These are challenging times. However, the great thing about what we're doing doesn't require a lot of money. So we're able to operate on a shoestring budget and just be very careful with how we do our logistics with partnership organizations. So we kind of piggyback on what other people do, and we're able to send things into countries in a much more efficient way, a much more cost-effective way. But, you know, as far as, like, the big funders go, our really large funders are Eaton Corporation, and they haven't stopped at all. They pretty much support us carte blanche. When we go to them and we need radios, they donate them for this cause. And so we're still receiving lots of radios from them, lots of other support from them. Also, Universal Radio, who's a big supporter of ours, has been there for us. And I'd say a lot of the donors that we've been working with, they've only increased their donations over time, and they come back every single year. We're sitting here right now at the Winter Shortwave Fest, and in Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania, the folks here, every time I come here, we receive more and more donations.
Now, if somebody was to ask you, okay, Thomas, look, I just donated, let's say, $50, $50. How is that spent?
Well, in truth, the way our money is spent is primarily on logistics expenses. So it'll go into shipping, the bulk of it. Some of it goes into, we always tell people that it costs us about $40 to $50 to send a radio to one of the countries where we work, to the bulk of the countries where we work.
So one donation, $50, means one radio?
Yeah, basically, yes, that's correct. And in truth, you know, it varies a little bit from country to country. Some countries are a little cheaper to go into than others. But we try not to even look at that. We just want to get radios into the areas where they're needed most. South Sudan is probably the priciest country for us because the logistics required are pretty extensive.
Well, South Sudan is pretty much a new country. They're building infrastructure from scratch. There was nothing before.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. In fact, it's the lack of infrastructure that makes it so incredibly difficult. Plus, it's kind of dangerous taking the radios in there. We fly the radios into Nairobi, and our partner organization, Project Education Sudan, they actually take the radios the rest of the way, and they have to do it through chartered flights, through very, very long truck rides on roads that sometimes get washed out, have potholes in them, that have people that may hijack you on the way. It's very challenging. And once they get to where they go, we make sure, in fact, this is where a lot of our time goes into. We make sure that each and every piece of technology we send out is 100% functional. We do 2 to 3 quality checks on them before they go out the door. We can't risk putting all that effort, all those resources behind technology, and then the technology not work when it gets there.
Since the last time we spoke, there have been a number of cutbacks in international broadcasting. The BBC, for example, Radio Netherlands had a substantial cutback and will be cutting many of their shortwave frequencies. And in Africa, I mean, the top international broadcasters that are listening to are Radio France International in French, in the French part of the continent, BBC World Service in English and French, and also the Voice of America. With all these cuts going on, do you say to yourself, what are we going to do? Or is there still enough out there that it still worthwhile to do this?
Yeah, where we work, there are still shortwave broadcasts going there. Broadcasters have been pulling out of, I think, pretty important areas. But at the end of the day, where we're working, people are still receiving those broadcasts. Now, it concerns me greatly that international broadcasters are not doing the research that they need to do to find out who's listening in these countries. I think that there are a lot of countries around the world that are ruled by repressive regimes. There are countries in the world that do not have access to electricity. They don't have access to telecommunications like other parts of the world do. Yes, mobile phone technology is there in a lot of these areas, not necessarily where we work in South Sudan, but in a lot of areas mobile phone technology is penetrated, but there's a lack of electricity to operate the cell phones. If there's one thing that we've been doing this year, you're asking about some of the new things. Last year, I spent a great deal of time talking to broadcasters, international broadcasters, letting them know what we do, that we're listening, and that we could be a resource for the stories they need about their listenership. We also have been trying to make people aware of what's going on in international broadcasting so they can talk to their local representatives and maybe talk to the governing bodies in their countries. People write me all the time, how can I help? How can I help Ears to Our World? And I always tell them, contact your government. Contact the people who are in the governing body over your international broadcasting stations and let them know that international broadcasting is a very important, very viable lifeline of information.
For this year, what are your goals for the next 12 months?
Our goals for the next 12 months are to increase the amount of radios that we're sending into South Sudan. We are working on a project in Rwanda where we want to take radios, but also I'd say the third new thing we're working on, and this is a very exciting project, is in response to what our teachers and children have asked for, which is they have a lack of information, and also in these areas, since there's a lack of electricity, they have a lack of lighting. And we're thinking more in terms of like personal flashlights or torches. And so we actually are very lucky in that one of our technical advisors, who's also a member of the Winterfest here, Greg Majewski, he has developed a flashlight for us based on some open source internet resources. It's an LED flashlight. It's very bright, white light, and it runs on dead AA cells. So you can take a AA cell that had been in another flashlight, in a radio, in whatever. You put it in this homemade flashlight, which has about 11 components. You can put it together yourself without solder, without any resources. And a dead AA cell can run the flashlight anywhere from 20 to 120 hours or more, depending on the quality of the cell and how far it was depleted. It surpasses anything that you could buy in a grocery store, in a supermarket. If you went out and bought a flashlight, it would not perform the way this one does. And they're very affordable. I would say that the cost per unit is going to be well below $2 per unit after we start buying in bulk. We're going to call this the Humanilite. And teachers and children will be able to build these. And it could spark an interest in electronics engineering in children. And it'll allow them to have a way at night that they can read.
I saw some of them earlier, made out of wood. The ones that are here at the SWL Fest, these are not the same ones that you're going to be sending out, or are you just, is the design going to be different?
The design will be very similar, actually. We may eventually sort of mass produce the board that the light will be put on. But actually, what Greg did, what you saw here, is the way that we want this to go. We want it to be a contextually appropriate technology, meaning a technology that works where it's going, where people can repair it easily. And when a part breaks, they could actually go replace the part with something locally. So all these parts can be sourced within Africa very easily, and they're all very inexpensive. You know, it's funny, you know, we struggle with radios. I mean, radios are much more complicated, and to have a good radio, you can't just build it necessarily unless you're an electronics engineer. Flashlights are much more simple. and these are easier to understand. And literally, in a suitcase, when you carry the components, you could probably carry thousands of flashlights in one suitcase, because the components weigh next to nothing. They're very small, and they pack away nicely. And so it's a very effective way of doing that. And once someone knows how to build one of these, they can build more. In Rwanda, what we're hoping to do is work with some teachers there in a school that they've just started. They need to raise funds for their school. We're going to give them the tools and teach them how to build the flashlights. And then they're going to take the flashlights, build them themselves, and sell them locally. And then the money from that will help support their school and help support the production of more flashlights for their community.
Thomas Witherspoon of Ears to Our World. Now, staying in Africa, one area of that region that's been getting a lot of news coverage lately is South Sudan. Now, if I said to you, radio can save lives, you'd probably say to yourself, Keith, you've got to be kidding. But no, it is true. In some areas of the world, radio does save lives. Canadian Janice Law, who's been working in radio for a number of years, has been to South Sudan training people of the United Nations peacekeepers. I had a chance to sit down with her and talk about the really important role radio plays in that part of the world.
Good afternoon and welcome once again in case you've just joined us. Don't forget that from 3 exactly, we shall be hosting, Mr. Terma Jok, who is an associate officer within Security Sector Reform. And we shall be discussing on a military justice in South Sudan. As we all know that no sooner than later, South Sudan will be announced.
Well, we have to get used to saying Sudan and the Republic of South Sudan. Because, of course, Sudan is, you know, the northern part. They have radio stations in Khartoum, all censored by the government, like Radio Dabanga. Those folks for broadcasting about Darfur got disappeared, and Amnesty International were looking for them. Anyway, so Sudan and South Sudan. Whereas in the Republic of South Sudan, there's no infrastructure there. There's no drinking water. There's nothing. There's no information. There's no media. There's no newspapers. In Bor, which is the capital of Jonglei State, there's not even a newspaper, let alone, you know, TV or radio. And these small radio stations try and get on the air because they know the importance of information. Radio Moriah, the UN station, they do a good job of getting information out about human rights, about the elections, about the referendum, and a lot of social issues are really well covered by Radio Moriah. Thank God they're there. But sometimes that's the only media for miles around, repeaters. But shortwave is so important because the media is still restricted by the local governments. All the BBC and RFI and VOA, they might have stations, say, in Juba, but if the local government doesn't like what they're saying, they'll pull the plug on them. So I don't agree with international broadcasters being on FM in a country. You need to be on shortwave where you can broadcast into a country, you know, the news, the real deal, and regardless of what the local government thinks. So shortwave is so important. I mean, in places like South Sudan, there was nothing else. And there were shortwave radios in the trucks and the vehicles, and people would sit around in the evening and listen to the shortwave. If you wanted to find out what was going on in the world outside of the country and what was going on inside the country from the view from the outside of the country, shortwave was essential. I mean, it's ludicrous that these big broadcasters is so irresponsible that they be cutting back. I mean, for whom? To save on the money? I mean, you've got hundreds of NGOs struggling to help these people, but government, you know, organizations like the BBC, the VOA, Radio Canada International, you know, the big boys, Netherlands, Deutsche Welle, they need to keep broadcasting to these countries where there's a desperate, desperate need of information. Information can save lives.
And the interesting thing, though, is many of these broadcasters will say, well, we're stopping shortwave to go to the internet. Now, I was reading some statistics recently where they said if you take Africa as a continent as a whole, except for maybe South Africa, which is in a different situation. But as a continent as a whole, less than 8% of the entire population have access to the internet. And they said, well, we're building infrastructure, but all the experts are saying yes, but that could take 15, 20 years because everything is so unstable in many places.
Yeah, but even the internet, it's so slow. I mean, you turn on the computer, open up a web browser, try and download even Hotmail. You have time to go for a shower, go for supper, to come back before one of your emails open. It's extremely slow. Just because there's no infrastructure, there's nothing there. They don't have landlines. Everybody's using cell phones. And even with the cell phone dongle for the internet, we couldn't get it. You know, the cell phone towers were too few and far between. So there's no internet. That's ridiculous. And again, shortwave and radio saves lives. To hear that there's NGOs coming in to rescue you when there's intertribal violence, when there's a drought, when there's famine. To be able to hear on the radio, listen, World Food Program has set up a feeding station at this town. If the villagers in a village can have a crank-operated shortwave radio and hear that there's help maybe a few kilometers away, which way do they march with their families and children on their back, and they march into the drought-stricken areas walking for hundreds of kilometers and dying on the way? Maybe they're going the wrong direction. If they could just get a shortwave broadcast that tells them, the World Food Program is set up in this area. We can't get to you, but come to us. We'll meet you halfway. It can save lives. Mm-hmm. Information about malaria, about dengue fever, about cholera, about hygiene. I mean, basic education. I mean, it's so essential, you know. I mean, the maternal mortality rate in Sudan was like 1 in 10 at birth. It's one of the highest in the world. The infant mortality rate is huge. I mean, just knowing about, you know, how and where to get to prenatal care, that there's Médecins Sans Frontières, there's different organizations willing to give pregnant mothers care to help them save their lives and save their babies' lives. And they might be in the next village, but they don't know that because there's no way of communicating. You have a shortwave station, communicates in their language, and say, okay, well, the World Food Program, Médecins Sans Frontières, the NGOs are set up here, here, and here. They'll hear it, and they'll go, and they'll get help, and it can save lives. And where is our social responsibility? Where is the social responsibility of these huge broadcasters?
Well, you know, the other thing, of course, that's playing a very important role in Africa right now, and it's popping up all over the place, are small community stations that broadcast to a particular area that will, let's say, tell women, okay, this hospital is not too far down the road. And it's amazing how something that we take for granted in the West is, like you said, it's really important to people's lives, and it does save lives.
Well, of course, the local community stations are great, and as long as they're allowed to broadcast this information freely. But the minute the government comes in and decides they want to take over the radio station or they don't like what's being talked about, they're off the air. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at Zimbabwe, where the radios were given out by the NGOs and the police were kicking in the doors and confiscating the radios. If you were found in possession of a shortwave radio or a radio period and you were listening to any other station other than the government broadcast, you know, you'd be penalized, you'd be beaten and the radio taken away from you. So the community stations are great as long as you have the freedom of the press and the freedom of the media to broadcast what you want. But once they become censored and once it decides the local government thugs in the area decide that they want to sell that radio in the black market for a couple of bucks, forget it, your radio's gone. Mm-hmm. Who has the radios? Who's going to broadcast? What's the message? And who's going to broadcast the impartial message? Is it really going to be for the good of the people, or is it going to become for the good of the local political power? So, I mean, there's a lot of questions. Yes, community stations are great as long as they're allowed to do what they need to do.
Now, in South Sudan, what is the main language in South Sudan?
Oh my, okay. Well, the official language is supposed to be English. The real official language is Juba Arabic. But there's 130 different tribes, which were from North Sudan and South Sudan at the time. And they speak Dinka, Nuer, Murle. I mean, the largest tribe in the south is Dinka. But there's Achole, there's Lakota, Taposa. There's so many different tribes. So most of the tribes, I mean, also the illiteracy rate is extremely high, especially amongst the women. Mm-hmm. There's like a 1% literacy rate amongst women, and there's maybe a 10% to 15% literacy rate amongst men. I mean, little girls aren't allowed to go to school for very long to learn anything because of the wealth that they provide in terms of the cow wealth, the dowry. Right. So a young girl would be shipped off by her father to a man to be married for 150 cows or so many cows, and the male in the family gets the cows. And basically she becomes the wife, which is the property of the man. She has no rights, and she has to stay at home and raise children, raise the livestock. Fetch water, build the fires, etc., and basically becomes a slave, a domestic slave. Mm-hmm. So the women are traded for cows. So there's no point in them going to school, because that their fate is that they're going to be somebody's wife. And what's the point of them learning another language? Because they're never going to use it, because they never get to speak to anybody.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the state of, you know, gender-based violence and child protection in South Sudan is horrific. Then the most marginalized of the marginalized. You already have these people who suffered through war and famine and drought and corrupt governments. And on top of that, they're totally discriminated against as a gender. Mm-hmm. So it's a sad state of affairs, but the illiteracy rate is extremely, extremely high for everybody. So to get everybody you know, on the same page in terms of what language, I mean, they speak English, the statutes are in English, but nobody can read it. And they haven't created the statutes in Arabic because they don't want to follow with Sudan. The North had everything in Arabic and forced them to learn Arabic. They speak Arabic, but they want English as a language for their new free democratic country. But nobody reads it or speaks it or writes it, so they don't understand any of what their new statutes entail.
So it's really going to take a lot of time.
Yeah, it's going to take a lot of time. I mean, the UN is now UNMISS-SS, the UN mission in South Sudan. There's still a mission in Darfur, which was, I mean, Sudan at the time, when it was just Sudan, it was the only country in the world that had two UN missions in it. Mm-hmm. The Darfur mission is still going on. The UN has been booted out of North Sudan, which was left of regular Sudan, and they're only in Juba now, in South Sudan. I mean, Juba's growing in leaps and bounds. It has to, because all the NGOs have scrambled out of Khartoum and now in Juba. But, and to get in and out of Juba, you have to go through Nairobi. I mean, the flights from Europe used to go to Khartoum. So a lot has changed in terms of, and of course, now that they have their democracy, burgeoning democracy in the south, they were used to be all united against the north. But now it's like, okay, who's going to be governor? And, you know, the SPLA and the SPLM, and who's going to be the boss? So governors are fighting amongst themselves. Tribes are fighting amongst themselves. Police commissioners are fighting amongst themselves. So now the civil war was the north and the south, but now the south is independent. The civil war is beginning internally. And you see more and more tribal violence. You see more and more political violence between political rivals. So everybody's now struggling who's going to be in power. Is it going to be a Dinka president of the South? Is it going to be a Nuer president of the South? Right now, Salva Kiir is Dinka, and the vice president is Nuer. And then there's other people from other tribes who want to dominate. And still, Abyei hasn't been settled. The contested zone of Abyei, which had a separate referendum because of the oil wealth there, and the North is still claiming Abyei to be theirs. The South is claiming it to be theirs. There was disputes over who was allowed to vote because the resident tribe were for Southerners and the nomadic tribe weren't. There was some debate whether or not they were going to be registered to vote were Northerners. So the Northern government just bombed Abyei all to heck so that the resident people would flee and leaving no voters. So Abyei still hasn't been settled yet. And so there's that bone of contention. Will that start another war between Sudan and South Sudan? Will there be a civil war in South Sudan? The oil has been cut off because the South Sudan's greatest wealth was from the oil, but the pipeline runs through Sudan, Old Sudan, North Sudan, and they were not only charging them huge fees to export their oil, they were stealing the oil. So South Sudan has stopped the flow of oil into the pipelines through the north. But that was their only way of getting the oil out of the country. So they have no money. They have no income coming in because the oil has stopped. So now they have to build a pipeline out through Kenya and find somebody else to take the oil off their hands. Or where's their source of income? So this new country, which was counting on the oil revenue, has no oil revenue. So it's just, and like, you know, the government employees are supposed to be taking a cut in pay and people aren't getting paid. And, you know, poor people or hungry people or angry people. Began to rise up against each other, and it's quite the volatile state, as it has been, it continues to be, but even more so than when I was there.
That was Janice Law talking about the important role radio plays in South Sudan. Well, what can we expect propagation-wise over the next few days? Here's our propagation guru, Dan Hensley.
And here's propagation for the week from May 26th to June 1st, 2012. The 10.7 centimeter flux will be 115 all week long until June 1st when it spikes at 120. The A index will be 5 all week long except for May 30th when it spikes at 8. The KP index stable at 2 except for May 30th when it spikes at 3. Sunspot groups 1483 and 84 are passing out of view at this time, and that brings us sunspot groups 1486, 88, and 89 into view. No large coronal holes on the Earth-facing side of the Sun have been spotted this week. With the A index being higher than 3 this week, we should see at least a slight increase of ground wave propagation due to a continued pattern of radio wave absorption. But if we have proper daytime ionization of the D and F layers this week, we could very well enjoy some nice nighttime band openings based on double hop propagation.
Thank you very much, Dan Hensley from Shortwave America, for this week's propagation report. Anyway, we've come to the end of this edition of Media Network Plus. You can also tune in, by the way, to the weekly edition that airs on the World Radio Network, Sirius XM in North America, and Sky Digital, as well as through many other partner stations and platforms around the world by going to the website to find out the times or listen to past editions. It's www.pcjmedia.com/media network plus all, one word. Once again, www.pcjmedia.com/media network plus all, one word. You can also send us an email to let us know what you think of this program, and also, if you're listening on shortwave, to get one of our QSL cards. Our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. So, on behalf of Paulette McQuarrie, this is Keith Parent wishing you well, hoping to see you all again very soon. So until next time, friends, 73s to you all and 88 to the ladies.
Graaft en draaft met geweld om ons goed en ons bloed en onze steden. Hoor de Spaanse trommel slaan, hoor Barra's trompetten. Zie hoe komt hij trekken aan,
PCJ Radio while on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher is a free news, talk, and entertainment mobile app available for your smartphone. Downloading is quick and easy. Just find Stitcher from the App Store. Then, during registration, hit the promo code box and enter PCJ to get automatically entered to win $100. For more information, go to www.pcjmedia.com and click on the Stitcher logo on the right menu. PCJ Radio on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio.